Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Tai Lang Moore's come up from Canberra, of course, which is great. Take a seat, Diane. My great admirers of the Australian Dictionary Biography, and if you look down the back there, that's the office set, and about to be increased by the purchase of volume 17, in which Janet Grundy's bought some tonight. And we've also got a set at home, of course, so we can't be without it. Anyway, Di Langmore's here tonight to speak. First, she's the general editor of the Australian Dictionary of Biography, and volume 17 has just come out. She's the author of four books on biography, but I guess the best known of which are Prime Minister's Wives, about the wives of the Australian Prime Ministers, and Glittering Surface. Surfaces, which is the biography of Mae Casey, the wife of Richard Casey. Dick Richard Casey. Yeah. The former Minister for External Affairs. And tonight, Di Langmore's going to speak for us on the Australian Dictionary of Biography, a national asset. Many thanks.
Thanks very much, Stuart, and good evening, everybody. I'm grateful for this opportunity to tell you something about the Australian Dictionary of Biography today. As having worked on it for 25 years, I can scarcely believe it, its project dear to my heart and one that I hold in high esteem. A recent reviewer described it as, quote, arguably the nation's most substantial and significant publishing venture, and among the greatest of its kind in the world. Professor Stephen Garton of the University of Sydney has described it as the largest work of collaborative scholarship in the arts or social sciences in Australia. I'll begin by giving you a brief history of the project, which is this year, half a century old. Next, I'll describe briefly how a volume of the ADB is created and tell you about some of the challenges we're facing as our volumes move perilously close to the present. And then I'll conclude with a few thoughts about the role of a National Dictionary of Biography. My brief account of the early history of the ADB draws on research undertaken by the historian Jerry Walsh in Canberra. At a meeting of historians from throughout Australia, held in Canberra in August 1957, Sir Keith Hancock proposed that a national biographical dictionary should be produced. He'd just returned from Oxford to take up the chair of history in the Research School of Social Sciences at the Australian National University in Canberra. While in England, he'd been involved with the Dictionary of National Biography, the grandfather of all modern dictionaries of biography. The meeting agreed to his proposal. At that time, Professor Laurie Fitzharding was already compiling a national biographical register in the History Department of the Research School of Social Sciences, and it was decided RSSS would be the home of the new project. Planning proceeded smoothly at first. A small staff was appointed, a national committee formed, and working parties established in the state. But then, the project was almost wrecked by one of the two historians appointed to edit Volume 1, Malcolm Ellis. According to Brian Fletcher, author of the entry on him in Volume 14 of the ADB, he, quote, relished and sometimes created controversy, revealing his capacity to be, quote, vituperative and savagely outspoken. All his venom was unleashed on the project when he found himself at odds with the other leaders over policy and administrative issues. Declaring that he could not work with his co-editor, Manny Clark, Ellis threatened, for about a sixth time, to resign. To keep the peace, he was given Volume 1, and Manning Glass Volume 2. But his attacks on the editorial board did not diminish. And finally, in January 1962, Hancock removed him as editor and member of the editorial board. Ellis avenged himself in 1966 by reviewing Volume 1 for the Bulletin under the heading Disaster in Australian Research. This vicious episode, much of it played out in the national press, could have wrecked the ADB at the start. It was saved by the calibre of the board members, office staff and state working parties, and above all by the appointment of the first general editor, Professor Douglas Pike, who came from the University of Tasmania to head the project. Bede Nairn, who succeeded Pike as general editor, described him in volume 16 of the ADB as, quote, incomparably the country's best academic editor. Pike edited volumes 1 to 5 of the dictionary before his untimely death in 1974. Bede Nairn edited volume 6, then with Geoffrey Searle, volume 7 to 10. Searle edited volume 11, and John Ritchie volumes 12 to 16, with me as co-editor of 16. Volumes 1 to 2 cover those who flourished between 1788 and 1850. Volumes 3 to 6, 1851 to 1890. Volumes 7 to 12, 1891 to 1939. With volume 13, we changed the criterion for inclusion from the Flowerwood principle, that is when an individual was deemed to have flourished, to date of death. This has brought us into line with most other dictionaries of biography, including the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, successor to the Dictionary of National Biography in England. Volumes 13 to 16 thus covered people who died between 1940 and 1980. Like the ODNB, we are now proceeding by decades, and we've just completed this volume 17, the first of two for those who died between 1981 and 1990. It will be launched by the Governor of Victoria next Tuesday, 20th of November. Production of a volume of the ADB is a complex process, involving a host of volunteers as well as the salaried staff of ANU. Working parties in each state, as well as the Commonwealth and an Armed Services Working Party, draw up lists of subjects. They also nominate authors, choosing an outstanding authority on that individual or that area of specialisation. The general editor then invites the authors, about 550 per volume, and advises, encourages, coaxes and cajoles, and sometimes even bullies, until their articles appear at the ADB. We're often asked who gets into the ADB. The first criterion is that they must be dead. To qualify for a particular volume, they must have died within the period covered by that volume. As you would expect, many of those included are individuals who have been eminent at that time as leaders in politics, the law, the arts, science and medicine, business and industry, academia, sport, etc. But the ADB is more than the pantheon of great men and women. As well as the luminaries of Australia's past, we include less well-known individuals whose lives and achievements encapsulate aspects of the Australian experience. Into Keith Hancock's words, people, quote, widely representative of endeavour and achievement on every front of our experience as an emergent nation. Thus, earlier volumes contain, for instance, a representative shearer, a drover, a rabbiter, a barmaid and a circus performer. We include the infamous as well as the famous, especially if their infamy is judged to have had an impact on the warp and woof of Australian history. A recent example is Ronald Ryan, whose hanging generated a significant debate leading to the abolition of capital punishment in Australia. We also have bushrangers, swindlers, forgers, and even a self-styled witch. Rosalind Milton. Every single verifiable fact in every entry is checked by our excellent team of research editors. Because the entries are so densely packed and the style so concise, there might be some hundreds of separate facts to check in a single entry. Research assistants collect source material to enable the editors to do the meticulous checking. We write hundreds of letters to institutions seeking confirmation about subjects' affiliations and credentials, as well as obtaining all available birth, death and marriage certificates and service records. For subjects who died at 70 years or younger, we give cause of death, which is checked by a medical practitioner looking at the death certificate. I count this as giving you one of the strangest causes of death in the ABB. Sadly, the cricketer Stanley McKay fell and died in 1968 while trying to throw a dead possum over a cliff. Unlike Who's Who, we do not simply present a string of facts about the individual's life. All ABB articles are essays of between 500 and 6,000 words that attempt an interpretation and an evaluation of that life. The general editor has the final responsibility for assessing whether the article is an accurate, fair, balanced and comprehensive interpretation of the individual's life and work. Have all the facets of the life been covered and given appropriate weighting? Have the gaps and puzzles of the life been adequately explored and a reasonable conclusion reached? Has the significance of this particular life and career been accurately evaluated in the context of its time? We strive to respect the author's interpretation of the subject, provided it is soundly based on the available evidence. After the authors have approved the edited version, the articles are sent in print-ready form to Melbourne University Press, which has been our admirable publisher ever since Volume 1. A wonderful new dimension to the production of the ABB has been our illustrated searchable website, ABB Online, launched by the Governor-General in 2006. It includes all the approximately 4,000 articles published in the volumes of the ABB, with portraits added where possible. By providing both free and structured text searches, it opens up the treasure trove of 8 million words to lateral searches that have not been easy to conduct in the print volume. Users can key in a name, a phrase, a concept or a theme, and within seconds obtain a hyperlinked list of all the relevant entries. Thus, for instance, if one keyed in draft, one would find 345 relevant entries. Tuberculosis yields 266, this is very random this, Davis Cup 18, Australia First Movement 10, Australian Mutual Provident Society 146, and Conscription 420. The trailing text that appears with the entry's name on the list enables readers to assess whether the entry will be useful or not. With the structured search, they can identify cohorts through such variables as date and place of birth, residence and death, occupation, cultural influences, and religious affiliation, as well as various combinations of those factors. Going online has made the ABB more accessible to scholars, genealogists, schoolchildren, journalists, and indeed to a vast number of the general public. We're just short of 40 million hits in 16 months, which we're pretty proud about, averaging 120,000 hits per day. Every day we handle a large email correspondence, some of it simply congratulatory or appreciative, but some of it drawing attention to errors, especially in the earlier volumes. One of the great advantages of the website is that once those mistakes have been investigated and confirmed, the corrections can be made instantly online, rather than having to wait for the printed corrigenda that accompanies each volume. Unlike the volumes, which are in a sense frozen in time, the website is a dynamic, growing artifact for which we have further plans. Another great aspect of ABB Online is that it has become part of a global electronic research network linked to other sites. For instance, if you open the article on our first Prime Minister, Sir Edmund Barton, you can read the entry, go to the bibliography, click on the item Barton Papers, and go straight to the National Library's shelf list, select an item, and have the letter or diary entry appear on your screen, all without your leaving your desk. Similarly, if you're reading an ABB entry on a serviceman or woman, you can often click on the bibliographical entry for his or her service record and open it up on your screen. At this stage, not all service records have been digitised by the National Archives of Australia, but they will be eventually. Thanks to our links with Picture Australia, One can go straight from the portrait illustrating the article to the picture gallery containing all the images of that person held by the contributing libraries. This global network of related sites will become denser and more comprehensive as other institutions increase their digital resources. As our volumes creep closer and closer to the present, there are new challenges and new dilemmas. One problem that confronts us is the one that I've already alluded to, the deficiencies in the early volumes. This is no reflection on Douglas Pike or anyone else involved in their production. We're fortunate these days to have a highly skilled research staff. In Pike's day, he undertook much of the research himself, with the help of one or two research assistants. But it's not only staff resources that have changed. The discipline of Australian history and the availability of sources have burgeoned over the last four decades. When the ADB began, Australian history was a discipline in its infancy. And in fact, the ADB was at the forefront, identifying the major actors, uncovering sources about them, and documenting their lives. More than one full-scale biography was started out as an ADB article. It was pioneering work. Not surprisingly, mistakes were made from time to time. Co-agenda are published with each volume as new information comes to light. And let me digress again for a moment to tell you of our most famous co-agenda. It's for an entry on James Atkinson, settler and author, in volume one. The article says, his first child, Charlotte Elizabeth, died in infancy. The co-agenda reads, his first child, Charlotte Elizabeth, lived to a ripe old age and we don't usually get it as wrong as that, but some mistakes are inevitable. Even more significant than small factual errors is the recognition that, as the discipline has become increasingly sophisticated, early interpretations sometimes now appear inadequate or even incorrect. It's tempting to envisage it totally redoing the earlier volumes in the light of contemporary scholarship, as the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography has just done. However, resources being scarce, we've decided to push on with volumes 18 to 20 to complete the 20th century at this stage. Another of the most daunting challenges of the present moment is that of perspective. As we're pressing closer to the present, we sometimes feel that not enough time has elapsed to assess the life and work of our subjects. Reputations can wax and wane, especially in fields such as the arts, science, and scholarship. The shape of a life only becomes truly visible in retrospect. Historians like to have 20-20 hindsight when making assessments. Related to this is the problem of access to recent sources. We manage reasonably well to work with the 30-year archival rule, as individuals tend to make their most significant contributions some years before their death. But we're increasingly frustrated when seeking access to personal collections of papers that we find have been embargoed for stipulated periods. Even more concerning for us is a move by Australian Registrars General to refuse access to birth, death and marriage certificates because of privacy considerations. Accurate and comprehensive birth, death and marriage information is the cornerstone of our ADB articles, and we will be paralysed if we are denied access. We're not happy to compromise with any less authoritative sources, knowing that our preeminent reputation depends in large part on the high level of accuracy that we provide. Another very real problem is that as we come closer to the present, more spouses and children of our subjects are still alive. We've experienced only a few attempts by families to control the information provided in entries, but even when families don't intervene, one is still mindful that it might be someone's close relation who is being dispassionately dissected in an ADB entry. The family can be embarrassed, hurt, or even shocked by what might be revealed in the article. Mores have changed, but there is still some need for sensitivity. Sometimes our detailed scrutiny of birth certificates reveals a hitherto unacknowledged illegitimacy, or the lack of a marriage certificate can point to a de facto relationship. Most young people nowadays would not find this a cause for concern, but for elderly sons and daughters of our subjects, justifiably proud of their family's history, such revelations can cause hurt and embarrassment. There are many such personal issues that are potentially critical to decision: alcoholism, homosexuality, extramarital affairs, sexually transmitted diseases. We had our first AIDS-related death in 2017, financial irregularities, etc. Dr. Samuel Johnson recognised this dilemma of the biographer in the 18th century. Quote, "What is known can seldom be immediately told, and when it might be told, it is no longer known." There's no easy formula. All we can say is that we never knowingly tell an untruth in our articles, but that consideration for descendants must sometimes require some discretion. Each case has to be judged individually. Another very practical problem that we face at present is the issue of funding. The Australian National University has generously funded the project for the last half century and will continue to do so, but the pressure is increasingly strong to find external sources of funding. We deliberately chose to make ADB Online a free website, conceiving of it as a gift to the nation. But having made that choice, we're now looking for other funding sources. Some years ago, we established an Endowment for Excellence Fund with a generous donation from a Sydney author, the late Mrs. Caroline Simpson. We've since received several other requests, but we are very keen to build up the fund and to explore other possible avenues, so any suggestions are welcome. Finally, why do we have a National Dictionary of Biography? The urge to commemorate heroic lives has a long history, stretching back at least to Plutarch. The Dictionary of Biography thus becomes the verbal equivalent of a portrait gallery or an avenue of statues devoted to those whose lives are deemed worthy of remembrance. It might not be a dictionary of national biography. It could be a dictionary of a particular occupational group, such as writers, artists, or scientists, or it might be an ambitious universal dictionary of biography. But in 18th and 19th century Europe, this commemoration of the great and the good was seen to have an additional purpose, that of nation building. A dictionary of national biography was regarded as an essential accessory of the nation state. Keith Thomas of the ODNB has written about one of its mid-18th century predecessors, Biographia Britannica, which sought to advance, quote, the reputation of our country and, quote, the honour of our ancestors. Such an avowedly nationalistic impulse has the potential to cause the historical record to be subverted, as we know has happened in various totalitarian countries. Sir Leslie Stephen, creator of the monumental Dictionary of National Biography in Britain in the late 19th century, was too fine a scholar to allow the DNB to be manipulated for such crudely jingoistic purposes, but it did remain largely a celebration of the great man. In the 19th century, this orientation was reinforced by the conviction of influential writers such as Carlyle and Emerson that, quote, history is the essence of innumerable biographies, Carlyle, 1838, or more sweepingly, quote, there is properly no history, only biography, Emerson, 1841. The cataclysmic events of the 20th century, together with a more sophisticated understanding of the dynamics of society, have spelt the end of Carlyle's great man theory of history and a suspicion of the nationalistic aspirations that prompted earlier enterprises. Modern dictionaries of biography are less heroic and more democratic in orientation. I'm proud to say that the ADB was in the vanguard of the move to include representative people along with the great and good. While the lives of the latter can be read for information and perhaps even for inspiration, I believe that the Dictionary of National Biography is an even more precious resource for the information it provides on the less eminent citizens, whose lives are often unknown and whose contribution might otherwise be overlooked. It's easy to find information on Sir Robert Menzies, for instance, starting with Alan Martin's two-volume biography, or the 588 papers, boxes of his papers in the National Library of Australia. But where would you go but to the ADB for a biography of George Abdullah, Aboriginal community leader, Larry Adler, businessman, Marjorie Barnard, author, Lyndall Barber, radio actress, Michael Bielogoski, spy, Ruby Boy Jones, coast watcher, or Vera Buck, composer? Those names are picked almost randomly from the beginning of volume 17. Whatever the influence of the leaders of the nation, it's through the efforts of myriad individuals, often working in collaboration with each other, that the nation is formed. The founders of the ADB have been modest and reticent in their claims for it. They would have been wary of the nationalistic imperative that prompted some earlier dictionaries of national biography, but they would have had to acknowledge that even without the avowed intent of nation building, this magisterial publication does have an impact, even if only incidentally, on the nation. It is, according to the historian Jerry Walsh, the great repository of Australian national identity. National identity can, of course, be a dangerous or a vacuous concept. It can degenerate into a simplistic, celebratory jingoism or a green-hide and stringy-bark nostalgia. However, I believe that the restraint of the ADB, the commitment to scholarship, the insistence on accuracy, and the emphasis on critical evaluation all form a corrective to any such tendency. The ADB leads us towards an honest, sober, and informed sense of national identity, one which acknowledges weaknesses as well as strengths, failures as well as successes, evil as well as goodness, and aspiration as well as achievement. Through its inclusiveness, it recognises the contribution of the many disparate elements of Australian society, including its minority groups, and weaves them all into one rich, intricate tapestry of Australian history. The dictionary of biography thus becomes, without any blatant nationalistic agenda, a preeminent resource for understanding of the nation's history and of the individuals who created it. A reviewer describing the ADB as one of the Australian National University's three great achievements, the others were Finrock and the work of its medical Nobel laureate, said that it set on record for all time the Australian experience. Long may it continue to do so. Thank you.
Thanks, Di. Now, Jennifer is here, I think. So I think Jennifer would be happy to take any orders for volume 17, 1981 to 1990, A to K. This one's ours. Can I just say congratulations for the work you're doing, as we come to questions and discussion, and congratulations for the incentive you're providing for baby boomers and near baby boomers, who now, in the latest word, are now incentivated to live beyond 70, so the cause of their death will not be known. It's quite an incentive. It was like the famous line out of Hancock when it was put to him that before he went for a blood test, is whether he had a number of diseases, and he said, well, certainly not, and particularly not that one. So we come to question discussion. Can I just start off, because you made an important point about the historical record not being perverted, and of course that's true, but there is at least, as you're aware, one instance where an entry in the dictionary is essentially a hatchet job by a person against someone he didn't like. Now, the person is Jim Griffin. He was my teacher at school. He's spoken at the Sydney Institute. But the job he did on Archbishop Daniel Manx, the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, is very much a hatchet job. I mean, what governance to that? Does that stay on books forever as a hatchet job? Or now it's online, can there be dissenting opinions?
That's a good question. The best thing to say is that if there are any factual errors in it, they should be corrected immediately. But as you know, history is not an exact science, and there is scope for a vast range of interpretations. I hasten to add, I wasn't general editor when that article went through. In fact, I was on my sick bed at the time. But, I don't know. We're partly dependent on the state working parties who recommend authors to us. And so this recommendation came from the Victorian State Working Party. I think the article was toned down, amended to some extent. We don't, on the whole, refuse articles. We just try to bring them up to scratch. So at this stage, unless there are factual errors, there's nothing we can do about it. But there is this is one of the future possibilities that we're talking about, you know, that ADB Online might give us the scope for discussion pages so that the entry itself isn't altered unless it's actually wrong, but there is scope for comment by dissenting voices.
Okay,
Would you think that's a good way for us to go?
I think that's a very good way to go. And I know that, you know, some members of the surviving members of the Daniel, younger members of the Daniel Mannix fan club would be happy to put up their hand to write Duke Griffin's entry. That never happens to come about. It may live forever. Okay. Yeah.
Look, I'm one of these wretched people that gets lots of letters from you saying that you undertook to have your entry written by such and such a time and you haven't. So I've done several.
Yes,
the only bits that worry me that I've written, I might have made mistakes, but if I made a mistake now, it's accurate in 50 years because it was in the 18th people believe. Yes. The bit that worries me is that I've been slightly intimidated to write things that are more hagiographical than biographical. I don't think I'm the only one in this. And I know you've referred to this, and Gerard has referred to it a bit. They've never asked me to write Daniel Mannix, so I know that. But there are somewhere, I just wonder if the habit of excessive hagiography is something that's become institutionalised. And I take a share of the blame. I don't know what one can do about this.
We always try to tone down the hagiography. You know, we do get a lot more hyperbole in the articles that come in than the versions that are published. But I think it is a problem related to the question that the issue that very often spouses or sons and daughters are still alive, and very often our authors have consulted the spouses and the sons and daughters for information. And in that situation, it is hard to... But we try to have a sober but fair analysis.
Often your professional career can get a big kick in the pants if you say the wrong thing about someone who's only been dead 10 or 20 years.
There is one real dilemma with moving so close to the present, I think. You know, I envy the freedom of people who are writing about 18th century characters because no one's going to get... You're hurting the family. You know, that is a problem writing about reasons. But there should be a wear media, you know, where you don't hurt them, but you're not excessively hagiographical, I think. And that's what we strive for. Maybe we don't achieve them.
Do you remember how you handled Harold Holt? I think that was in the because I mean I think it's fairly clear that of the three sons, two are sons of Zara, although it was said they were sons of Zara's first husband. I'm trying to remember whether that was sort of fessed up to there.
And he did say it, and he had talked with the sons who were quite happy for that to be. In fact, very eager, I think, for it to be acknowledged.
What if they hadn't?
Well, then, it really depended on their testimony, because I just don't think there's evidence in the written record. I remember when I was doing my chapter on Zara for Prime Minister's Wives, I'd heard this rumour, and I looked as assiduously as I could, as shipping lists, you know, to see whether she was back in Australia at the relevant time, but I couldn't prove it. So I think Ian really depended on the sons acknowledging that this was so.
Ian also told the story that Zara's third husband, Bate, said that he was well used to looking at prime cattle and he could pick the offspring.
I think he had a bit of help on that one.
Right.
My favourite review by M.H. Ellis of one of Manning's works was Ellis's review of Manning's first volume of the history of a short history of Australia. And it's a wonder that Manning, after Ellis documented all these errors, ever went and wanted to write another volume. But I was wondering if you could venture an opinion on the current state of obituaries that we read in Australian newspapers.
We do find them helpful. We depend on them a lot, but more for the basic sort of factual information. They're starting points for us. You know, it's often from obituaries. We get enough information to order the death and marriage certificates and to write off to Cambridge University or whatever to get a student record. But, and we would certainly take into account the evaluation by the person writing the obituary. But we wouldn't just blindly take it over as our evaluation of that person. It would be one factor.
Do you think they're good and are they improving or do they need improvement?
I think they vary, and my greatest lament is that they're declining in number rather than inequality. You know, I think obituaries are a wonderful institution and I wish all the papers would continue to give them prominent spaces.
There are a lot of being written by children and which causes some problems. Although, not necessarily.
Yeah. Two quick questions. How do you allot the number of words for a particular person? Because some of them had a life that was so complex and so long, and they may, you may devote 2,000 words, whereas somebody has only 500 words. Mm-hmm. The second question is, I notice you have no index. Would it be eventually possible for all the volumes to have one volume, whatever its thickness will be, of a author as well as the subject index? By subject index, I mean you could list all the different professions.
Yes.
You know, there are 100 for being for philosophers, you know, 50 medical researchers, etc., etc.
To answer your second question first, there is actually an index to volumes 1 to 12, and there was talk of doing a subsequent index, but in a way it's been overtaken by the online material, because, for instance, if you wanted to find out about philosophers, all you need to do is key in philosophers online, and you'd instantly get all the articles about philosophers. There is an index to the authors
in the volume.
Elementary list. But I think probably we wouldn't. We would think now with the online facility there that it wouldn't be worth doing another one. And that's your other question. That's an interesting one. We allocate a certain number of words and a certain number of entries to each state and to the armed services and to the Commonwealth, and we divide them up, the 500,000 words are divided up according to what the population of that state was at the period under review. So for instance, New South Wales has a very long list and Tasmania has a very tiny list.
Yeah.
So New South Wales gets its allocation and it knows then that it has that many words at its disposal. So the state working party then works out if Robert Atkins should get 5,000, I think it's about 3,000 words actually, and someone else will only get 500 because his life's not so significant.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you handle the culture wars? People have very different views on people,
don't they? As I think I've tried to say, we try to respect the interpretation of the author. You know, we review their interpretation, and certainly if it's not based on the evidence, then we challenge it. But because there is scope for a whole range of opinions, we try to give the author his or her name that's at the bottom of the article. So it's important that his or her interpretation should come through in the article.
How do you select the contributor to the writing of the article?
That's also done by the state working parties. It's interesting, though, Australian history is still very much state-based. So I can't sit at my desk in Canberra and say which West Australian should be in the dictionary and which West Australian historian should write them. It's much better that the historians in Western Australia decide which article should go in first, and then who's the appropriate person to write that article. And they try to get the very best person to write the article. So it might be a PhD student who's doing a thesis in that subject, or it might be a senior historian who's written in that area, or it might be someone who's already written a biography of this person. It works both ways. We have ADB articles that become full-scale biographies, and we have authors of full-scale biographies who write beautiful little condensed ADB entries. So, but it is the state working party's decision. Basically, they recommend to me, and on the whole, I accept their recommendations because I understand that they know the local scene much better than I do.
Yeah. Yeah, but who appoints the safe working parties?
Well, I suppose I did. No, they're self-perpetuating, and as soon as one person leaves the state working party, the chair of the state working party, in this case Professor Jesse Bolton, would write to me and say so-and-so is leaving and I recommend that we bring on another person. And again, normally I'd say yes, I can do good reason not to.
And if I may, Marie Casey, can you just sum up her life, please?
May Casey?
Yes.
Sum up her life? I've written a 1,000-word book. What do you want to know about? I mean, she was an intriguing woman. She was multi-talented. She was an artist and a writer and a flyer and a great socialite. She wrote one really good book, An Australian Childhood, and some which were not so good. She was very enigmatic in personality. She had a wide circle of friends, but she was a dreadful mother, as her daughter Jane McGowan will freely tell anyone who asks. She was very, very ambitious for Richard Casey. I think she was the driving power behind him during a lot of his life. She had vitality and exuberance and liveliness. She was a very interesting person to work on, but
You've done the entry on May Casey and the
we're working on it at the moment. It's not completed, and it will probably be three years at least before the next volume is
published. So you actually decide all the names, and then split the alphabet, and then start working the front half of the alphabet.
That's right.
I'm not quite sure if that was the way it is. Yes. So hopefully you've got all your names in place.
Yes.
Otherwise this might be something missing.
That's right, yes. Yes, it's too late if we discover any more.
It's about 3 years is the process.
At least 3 years. I was saying to Jared, we've had severe staff shortage cuts over the last 2 years, and we're working with very reduced staff at the moment. So three to 3.5 years is a cracking pace, and we might have to take more given that we are so short of staff. But then, there's a problem that we've been talking about. That as you get closer to the present, it becomes more of a problem, more fraught. So maybe it's not altogether a bad thing if the next body doesn't come out more quickly. It's hard to know. I mean, some people want the people who died yesterday to be in there. But that's not the issue.
Okay, so
the question here. Yes. To what extent do the successive volumes reflect changes in political correctness, because have been written 50 years ago would not be written now.
You're quite right. That's a very interesting point. And when we put the whole of the ADB online, the agreement we had with MEP was that the online version would mirror what's in the print volumes. But there were some things we just couldn't put online. The comments about wild savages and so on, we just toned down a little bit in one or two places. So that's one thing, and also a much greater consciousness now to include Aboriginal identities in the ADB. So the proportion of Indigenous people has gone up dramatically in recent volumes. And the same is true for women, actually, because if you look at the early volumes of the ADB, they're very male-dominating. And it's not altogether that they are obtuse about it, it's just that in those days not so much work on women's history had been done, and people didn't have the resources to write about women. But I think there's also a more conscious effort now to make sure that more women are included.
Yeah.
One problem that I've never known quite how you work it out is what to do with people that have education and early career in Australia and then their major career overseas. And one, I don't think he ever made it even to the missing person one, was Frank Shee, to show that I'm not a totally bigoted Protestant, who was educated here, brought up here, and was very much an Australian. But he married, he was a big Catholic, and he married Maisie Ward, I think it was a niece of the Duke of Norfolk, and was a very well-known proselytiser for Catholicism in Britain. Now, I don't think he ever made it in. What's the rule? Because his early career was in Australia.
Yeah, it's not a hard and fast rule. Insofar as we've got a rule of thumb, we'd normally say now, you know, if they were born in Australia and educated in Australia, that gives us enough of a claim to put them in the ADB. So if I were doing it now on the basis of what you said, you probably would go in. Maybe my predecessors were tougher. But conversely, you know, we have people like Trollope and Dickens, who only just visited Australia, breathed in and breathed out again, and yet they've got in. So there are inconsistencies there, I think. But I do feel that people are born and educated here, they should be concluded.
That was just sheer intellectual.
Hang on, we're going to
I think so.
Just two comments. First of all, your comment about women in the early biography. I was fascinated to find that the first woman novels was in Australia does not have a biography, which is incredible when you think how the men were lauded.
Who was that?
I think her name was Anna Maria Bunn, Captain George Bunn's wife. But anyway, that was just an agreement at that point. But on another issue, when you've got the only person who's written a biography on a person writing the ADB entry, it's very logical because, of course, they're the expert on that, but you also run the risk of having the whole public record biased in one direction.
Yes. That's right, and so for that reason we don't always do it. You know, Professor John Lanoz wrote the two-volume biography of Alfred Deakin, but then when the article came to be written 5 or 6 years later, the editor at the time decided that it would be good to get a fresh perspective on it. So we do work both ways, you know, depending on what seems best, but I think you're right. But you're right.
Did you notice when you checked volume 1 to the recent volume, whether there is a change in the style of English, the style of punctuation, the phraseology, and so on?
I suppose there are changes all the time. I found myself at odds with the MEP editor actually over a few punctuation issues. Douglas Pike used to quote that, like the Bible, because do the ADB with no adverbs at all. I think it's a little bit hyperbolic. I'm sure there were adverbs in the ADB, and there are certainly adverbs in the Bible. But I've always kept that in mind, you know, that sort of terse, concise, very lucid, elusive style, really, is what we aim for. But then at the same time, we're trying to respect the individual style of the author. So you might get an author who writes in a very Baroque style, and the next one writes in a very pared-back, austere style. And I rather like that. I don't like it all being reduced to a lowest common denominator. So we do try to allow for that variation.
To follow the gentleman's question about, have you included a lot of Australians who were living most of their lives overseas? Take, for instance, in the future, Miss Greer, who is now in England. Would you ever put her into a future book?
I think we have to.
I'd be happy to write her.
If she's brought up, you would be deeply prejudiced. I'm losing control of this. We better get it soon. So you've had troubles with commas at MUP. That's quite common. There was an argument at MUP recently about the editorship of Leangen, and he's stepping down now, but he said that he needed his own office at the University of Melbourne because he'd been having discussion with an author about the insertion of a comma in a sentence. You needed your own office.
Did you have to use violence?
Well, so commas down at MUP, commas matter. All the back of them. Okay, now we're going to wind up very quickly. Yep.
Just
concerning the people who were not born in Australia but lived here for most of their lives and became prominent citizens, they would be included.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing I should have said in answer to your previous question, that the third group of people who are getting a much better go now non-Anglo-Saxon people, you know, all the, we're dealing at the moment with that wonderful wave of post-war migration from Europe, and including a number of De Niro boys that we were talking about a while ago. And so, yes, their contribution is very gratefully acknowledged.
So just to conclude, you're essentially funded by the Australian National University. So just tell us, apart from every 3 years a book blobs out, the most recent one was the supplement, of course, in our volume 17, but what do you do during the day? just talk us through
for me my day starts with a huge correspondence and that's increased exponentially since we've had ADB online. You know, we could get up to 60 emails in one day, commenting on various articles online. Then apart from the usual administrative chores that one has as head of a program, the main thing I do is work with the research editors on the editing process. And each week the research editors put through two of those 600 articles in the volume. And it might sound easy, but as I've tried to explain, it's not just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. You know, they really do go and look at all the sources that the authors looked at, and they'll look at other sources if they think the authors overlooked some that should have been looked at. They'll tick every single statement on the page of the article to show that it's been verified. And you'd just be amazed. In the first sentence of the ADB, there are 20 or so discrete facts, you know, so-and-so, 1895 to 1914, was born on, at, first son of so-and-so, and his wife so-and-so, both Victorian-born. You know, each of those things has to be checked, and then you proceed through the article checking. And it often does take, you know, a lot of writing to institutions overseas to establish things, or burrowing into vast holdings of papers. So the research editors do all that, and then they give me the thoroughly ticked and version. That's probably in flawless prose by then, because they've worked on that too. And then I go through it all again. You know, I look at everything on file and anywhere else I think I need to look, just to make sure that those things that they have ticked are correct. So a lot of my time is taken up actually editing the articles too, you know, changing the colours and so on as well. And then I have a session with the research editors where we talk over the changes that I've proposed, and they mostly accept them graciously. Sometimes they'll say that they want to stick to what they had originally. Then we send them back to the authors, and the authors look at our edited version, and the nice ones say, "Wonderful, I hardly recognise it as my article." The nasty ones carp about little things that we've done. But that comes back to us then, and then we have to review what the author says. You know, is he right in saying that he was given that medal in 1965? We've got 1954. We'll have to go back to the sources again and see which one is right. Or can we let him have that extra sentence that he says is absolutely essential, even though it's under the word limit? So that's another stage of the process where we review what the author's done, and then we prepare for the MEP.
Final question, Anne.
In that, I'm just taking up that process. In the process of a person putting in the dates of birth and whatever, do you ask them to put copies of birth certificates and things that they've used for them, so you don't have to then go and look it up yourself?
It seems
that they could support everything they said if they had the evidence that you didn't have to do.
We tell them in the preliminary letter that we'll collect the birth, death, marriage certificates, service record and any other official documents, and if they want to, if they'd like us to, we send them that information so that they can incorporate it.
Because otherwise everyone would be going to...
That's right, yes. Yeah, sometimes we find when we go to particular holdings of papers, say the Mitchell Library or the National Library, the librarian will say, "That's funny, someone else was asking about these papers a month ago." You know, we're treading on the same ground.
So you spend time and make
it. Yes.
part of the question, what do you do if you lose your coragenic? Because they tend to fall out, and I know they're bound to a certain time, but can you get replacement coragenic?
I'm sure you could from MVP, yeah. But they were consolidated in volume 13.
Yeah,
I suggest
exposure copy immediately on
receiving. Yeah. But then you can always remember that the online version's got the
Corrigendary
Incorporated.
Yeah.
Good
stuff. Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Well, as you're aware, it was a great talk tonight. There's a huge amount of work goes into the ADV, and people there are extremely dedicated, but also have made an enormous contribution to Australian history. And I think the important point about the ADV is there's not much argument about it, which is good. I mean, they're not. There's occasional argument, by and large, and particularly in recent years, it's been extremely well accepted. So congratulations on tonight's speech. All the best with Volume 17, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future. But for tonight, well done, and thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.